This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris, and now our continuing summer series, Thrilled to Death. Today we spend some time with the writer Barry Eisler, the novelist behind two thriller series that have become international bestsellers. The first features a half-American, half-Japanese former military man named John Rain, who was turned into a high-paid and highly successful assassin. His second series revolves around the life of Ben Trevin, a black ops soldier with a wicked sense of humor. Eisler's latest book, Inside Out, looks at the shadowy world of CIA renditions and the central question of what constitutes torture when dealing with enemy combatants. As a former CIA operative, Eisler is a stickler for authenticity, so much so that if you visit his website, BarryEisler.com, he has an entire page devoted to mistakes, where he lists all, or at least most of the mistakes, readers have brought to his attention. Eisler joins us now to talk about how he researches his books, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michelle. Great to be here.
So the heroes of your books are generally some pretty bad dudes. They know their way around firearms and explosives, hand-to-hand combat, and you also happen to be an accomplished martial artist, and you attend several of these combat-style camps. Is this mainly to help with the authenticity of your books?
Well, it certainly does help with the authenticity of my books, and I've got all these weird books at home on techniques of unarmed killing and that sort of things. And so I know my wife, if she's listening, is saying, please, Barry, just tell them it's research. It's not a real interest. It's just research. But the truth is I've been into this kind of stuff since I was a teenager. And I'm glad to say that it certainly makes the books more realistic, but it's not just research. It's also a lot of fun.
So if I were to visit your home and scan the books in your library, I'd probably see some pretty spooky stuff.
I've got some great titles like You Are Going to Prison and 21 Techniques of Silent Killing and Breaking an Entry and Forging New Identity. Yeah, they were all they all used to be in a box, and then when I became a published novelist, my wife finally let me put them on the shelves because she can tell people, look, it's just research. He's not really interested in that sort of stuff.
How do you make sure that you get things right? I mean, it goes beyond just reading these books and looking at these manuals. I mean, if someone who's actually in the business, a CIA operative or someone who works in special ops, reads one of these books, how do you make sure that they say Barry knows what he's talking about?
I think if I have a talent for this sort of thing, it's mostly in that I'm pretty good at knowing what questions to ask and who to put them to. And so I've honed a process since I first since I wrote my first novel almost 10 years ago at this point. And that is, I'll start with, could be gambling for dummies or just something on the internet, and develop some basic knowledge of the area and learn what questions you need to ask. And then you want to start researching it more deeply, particularly by talking to experts now that you have some basic subject matter familiarity. And then the final step, which I've learned is indispensable, is you have to show the finished product, whether it's the whole book or just a certain scene or sequence. You have to show it to someone who really is an expert in that area, because no matter how much research you've done up until that point, you'll always make some small mistake that most people wouldn't notice, but an expert will. And once you've gone through that last step in the process, even the experts will say, wow, you really must, for example, you must be a Baccarat player. I'm not, but I did this sequence of research, and so, yeah, of course, it's passed muster with experts in manuscript form. So now experts find it extremely realistic when they read the novel as well.
Why did you decide on your website, BarryEisler.com, to include a page devoted to mistakes?
Well, from the beginning, realism has been really important to me. The kind of experience I've always wanted to provide for my readers is one in which, generally speaking, it's almost as though I've created fictional characters and dropped them into non-fictional circumstances. So the settings are real places, all the coffee shops, or the dojos, the streets, the whiskey bars, the jazz clubs. They're all as I have found them. The characters are as real as I can make them from my own experiences, from interviews with experts. Everything is as real as I can make it, but nonetheless, sometimes something does sneak through. And I want my readers to trust that realism experience I'm trying to provide them, and I think I can gain their trust not just through accuracy, but on those hopefully rare instances where something gets by me, by telling them, hey, that thing that I wrote about in whatever, it turns out that that was off, and you can read about it on my webpage.
I'm looking at this right now as I talk to you, and I hope we can spend some time now talking about the mistakes that the readers have found. In some cases, they're mistakes that you point out yourself in Rainstorm, in part of your series about the half-American, half-Japanese character named John Rain, you right. note that the stun gun Rain uses on a character named Crawley in Chapter 9 of Rainstorm would have left marks. And you say, I know this because I took a fan's advice after the fact and zapped myself with a stun gun?
Yeah, a fan wrote me and said that loved the book. And that's what most, by the way, most of the people who bring these mistakes to my attention, the letters are so nice. Like, oh my God, I love the book. I love this, this, and this. One thing you got wrong, and in this case, the one thing you got wrong is that a stun gun really does leave marks, and I have one, and I can send it to you if you'd like, and you can give it a try and just send it back to me. So I said, yeah, sure. And for sure, a stun gun does leave marks.
Okay, so describe for me how you zapped yourself with a stun gun.
Well, for what it's worth, I did try to be as careful as I could be. I've got wrestling mats in the garage and jammed the stun gun into my midsection. And it was very painful, attention getting. And I only zapped myself for, I don't know, a second. But I had two red welts at the electrical contact points. So from that, I realized, okay, got that wrong in the book. It does leave marks.
Now, some of this is very simple, like the pointing out that in some places whiskey is spelled with an E and sometimes it's not.
Yeah, you know, I'm embarrassed that I didn't know that when I first started because I love single malt whiskey and it's some of the most fun research I get to do. Irish whiskey is spelled with an EY at the end. Scotch whiskey is typically spelled with just a Y at the end. There are some exceptions, but that would be the norm. And I didn't know it. Apparently, the copy editor didn't know it. But legions of my fans know it, and now that's on my mistakes page.
Hmm. And the difference between an ex-Marine and a former Marine.
Yeah, that was another one. I can't believe it because I have so many former military people reading the manuscripts. An ex-Marine is one who is dishonorably discharged. A former Marine is just a Marine who served and then honorably left the service. So a former Marine never wants to be called an ex-Marine. And I didn't know that, but now I do.
And now I do, too. That's actually good to know. How is the industry responded to this? Do they applaud your mistakes page or do they think you're crazy?
Probably both. I got some nice mention, actually, in the Sunday New York Times book review a few years ago. The guy who wrote the column was really impressed that I did this. And I have to say I'm proud that I do it, too, regardless of what anyone in the industry might think. Since I think accuracy is important, if a mistake comes to my attention, then I think it's the right thing for me to do. To acknowledge the mistake publicly so that people can learn from it. And I'm sure that some people think it's a little crazy or masochistic or something like that, but it makes me feel good, and I think people trust me because of it.
Barry Eisler, thank you very much. It's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Michelle. So good talking to you.
That's Barry Eisler. His latest book is called Inside Out. NPR is assembling a list of the most pulse-quickening, suspenseful novels ever written, and we want your opinion. You can vote on the books you think deserve to be on our Killer Thrillers Top 100 list. Just go to the Summer Books section of NPR.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. And today, many doctors find themselves facing a difficult question. That's after a Food and Drug Administration advisory panel issued a ruling yesterday saying essentially two things, that the diabetes drug Avandia does increase the risk of heart attacks, but that the drug should remain on the market. So it now falls to doctors to field anxious calls from their patients and to decide when do the benefits of taking Avandia outweigh the risks. I'm joined now by one such doctor. His name is Daniel Einhorn. He's the president of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, or AACE. He's also a clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Diego. Dr. Einhorn, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Now, what are you hearing first from your patients?
Well, they may ask specifically, should I continue the medication? And what I'll say in that situation is if you feel the least bit of discomfort, lucky for all of us, in 2010, there are many alternatives. And so you need not suffer any concern about the medication. Even if the concern is remote or not firmly established, there's no reason to take a medicine that you or your friends or family are worried about. We have lots of alternatives.
Well, given the serious health questions that were raised, as a physician who's always thinking about the well-being of your patients? Would you advise them to move off of Andia?
Right. I have personally not requested patients to discontinue Avandia, remembering that the events that are being described are very rare. If someone is on Avandia doing well, there is no call to withdraw it, at least not at this point. Remember that the FDA has not made a final ruling. If you're not on Avandia and need to be treated for diabetes, there are many alternatives. And a doctor today would not likely choose to start Avandia given the serious health questions that were raised and not resolved. I don't believe there are going to be very many new prescriptions for Avandia written, certainly not for new starts in people with diabetes.
So you won't be writing new prescriptions for Avandia, but someone comes into your office and they say, Dr. Einhorn, I'm not sure I understand this. I mean, you're not writing new prescriptions, and yet you're advising me to continue with a drug that you obviously are not completely comfortable with.
Every time you change a drug, for example, let's say we would now pick a drug that we think has a better safety profile. In this specific individual, that drug may have issues that you're not having with Avandia. So if you know that a drug has been successful and well-tolerated, there is a good reason to not automatically withdraw that drug unless there's a very strong safety signal, because every change has its own risks.
I want you to reach back in your mind, if you can, before Avandia came under this investigation by the FDA. How was the drug viewed before the FDA started looking at its safety? How was it used in your practice, and how did people view it?
The class of drugs, which include Avandia, they were viewed with great enthusiasm. I had the privilege of being part of an NIH panel that really raised the question, should everyone with type 2 diabetes, indeed, should everyone with insulin resistance be given one of the drugs in this class? And I went through the evidence showing all the multiple studies that really showed what great benefit should inure from these drugs. I thank my lucky stars that I did not suggest, therefore, give everyone these drugs, because now we see that we can't always predict the benefits or ultimately the risks of every drug. And we need to follow them for as long a time as possible and as many people as possible and be very critical about our observations. And even a drug that seemed safe and seemed promising may let you down in the long run.
Dr. Einhorn, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Michelle. Thank you.
That's Dr. Daniel Einhorn. He's president of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, or the AACE, and medical director of the Scripps Whittier Diabetes Institute.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. A proposed Islamic cultural center and mosque two blocks from Ground Zero has become a flashpoint of controversy. The plans for Cordoba House are supported by most politicians in Manhattan and by religious leaders of many faiths. But in recent weeks, there's been growing tension over the project and some painfully raw emotions. NPR's Margot Adler has our story.
The plan for Cordoba House, which those who oppose it call a mosque and those who support it call a cultural center with a place for prayer, has been the dream of Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf and his wife Daisy Khan since 2004. Khan describes it as having facilities for
athletics, arts, culture, performances, lecture series, weddings, and also a much-needed prayer space.
The imam considers himself an Orthodox Muslim, but he's also a Sufi, a contemplative and mystical path in Islam. He and his wife run the American Society for Muslim Advancement, which is housed in a building used by many faiths that is part of Riverside Church. And Khan certainly sounds very much in that interfaith tradition.
Our religion has been hijacked by the extremists, and this center is going to create that counter-momentum, which will amplify the voices of the moderate Muslims. If we have to defeat the extremists, Muslims have to be leading that effort.
But at a Landmarks Commission meeting on Tuesday, the atmosphere was very different. Most of the speakers wanted the building to be landmarked because of 9/11. Landmark status would mean the building could not be torn down, creating roadblocks for the new Islamic Cultural Center. Here are Barbara Pellucci, Sam Nunberg, and Andrea Quinn.
The landing gear from one of the planes from 9/11 attack crashed into that building. And that should be a museum.
It would be like removing the sunken ship from Pearl Harbor to erect a memorial for the Japanese kamikazes killed in the attack.
To deprive this building of landmark status is to allow for a citadel of Islamic supremacy to be erected in its place.
Ziad Ramadan spoke in support of the center, saying he was a Muslim whose wife and brother were first responders after the September 11th attacks. He said it was un-American to say where a house of worship should be.
A lot of the rhetoric that you're hearing, it's the same thing that's happening in Staten Island. It's the same thing that's happening in Brooklyn. It's called Islamophobia, pure and simple. And do not allow...
Please let him speak.
Mayor Bloomberg supports the center. The community board for Lower Manhattan voted to support the project 29-1. In the race for governor, it's become a bone of contention with Republican candidate Rick Lazio calling on Attorney General Andrew Cuomo, his Democratic opponent, to investigate the project's funding.
This is a time when we need to ask serious questions that will keep the people of New York, and particularly the people of downtown Manhattan, feeling and actually being safe.
His Democratic opponent, Andrew Cuomo, says yes, some people are upset that the project is near ground zero.
The flip side, and what Mayor Bloomberg has said, we understand that. We also believe in the concept of freedom of religion and independence of religion, where government doesn't say what religions can be where.
Imam Faisal Abdul Rauf and Daisy Khan have not been totally forthcoming about their funding, but Khan told NPR on Tuesday that they are just in the process of forming a new nonprofit, that fundraising won't really start until after the Landmarks Commission rules. A recent poll on the question of the mosque showed that 52% of New York City residents opposed the center. In more liberal Manhattan, 46% of the residents approved it, and 36% were opposed. Maurice Carroll of the Quinnipiac poll says the most notable statistic is that while 55% of New Yorkers say Islam is a peaceful religion,
22% say that it encourages violence. They wouldn't say that about Jews or Catholics or Protestants, and the explanation of that has to be the terrorists have poisoned people's minds.
But the memory of the 9/11 terrorist attacks are being fueled by all kinds of bloggers and activists, many of whom don't live downtown. There's even a new TV ad put out by the National Republican Trust PAC.
On September 11th, they declared war against us. And to celebrate that murder of 3,000 Americans, they want to build a monstrous 13-story mosque at Ground Zero. This ground is sacred.
The proposed building is two blocks from where the tower stood. Meanwhile, Daisy Khan finds herself somewhat shocked at everything that's going on. When I said, people say you are bringing Muslim extremist law to the U.S., she says Muslims pray, they fast, they give charity. Most American Muslims don't want to do anything that violates American law.
America works because of its religious freedoms and because it does not allow any one religion to dominate another. And we are very happy as Muslims with that arrangement.
But clearly, some others are not. The controversy doesn't show signs of letting up, but except for the Landmarks question, the project has been approved. And even if Cordoba House has to stay within the existing building, it's hard to believe the project can be stopped. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
Mathematics, string theory, infinity, call centers in India, that's now the stuff of drama. As Jeff London reports, a play by Simon McBurney and London's theater Complicité tackles these subjects in a uniquely theatrical way called A Disappearing Number. It opens tonight in New York.
Director and author Simon McBurney likes to confront difficult subjects in his theater work. He says, like a lot of people, he's scared by mathematics, which is why...
I wanted to create a show in which mathematics was absolutely at the center of it.
But it took a while. He got the idea for A Disappearing Number over a decade ago when a friend handed him a book by a long-dead Cambridge professor named G.H. Hardy, called A Mathematician's Apology. His friend told him,
what fascinates me about this book is how he tells us that mathematical imagination and mathematical creativity are the same as any other artistic endeavor. I was at once hooked.
But as G.H. Hardy said, a mathematician, like a painter or a poet, is a maker of patterns. And just as in poetry and painting, the mathematician's patterns must be beautiful. Beauty is the first test, he said. There is no permanent place in the world for ugly mathematics.
In A Disappearing Number, McBurney weaves together several plot strands to illuminate the beauty, patterns, and mystery of mathematics. He looks at the true story of a young genius named Ramanujan, who left his poor village in India to work with Hardy in Cambridge during World War I. Ramanujan came up with formulas that are now the basis of string theory. Physicists use string theory to help explain the connection between the biggest and smallest elements of the universe. McBurney intercuts that story with a contemporary one about a math professor named Ruth and her husband, an Indian-born but thoroughly American futures trader named Al.
What I wanted to try and make present on the stage was a kind of emotional charge, which also comes directly through the work and through the numbers, just as it comes through the relationship and the human warmth between these people.
1 + 1/2 + 1/4 + 8 + 16 + 32. Oh, for God's sake, listen, Al, imagine two lines that shoot off into infinity,
Ruth,
forever.
I gotta go.
No, look, well, listen, Al, imagine those two lines do actually meet.
Right.
In infinity.
What are you talking
about? Well, I'm saying the impossible is possible. That's all, now, run.
I haven't understood anything you've said, but I'm feeling hopeful.
Well, you should. 1 + 1/2 + 1/4 + 1/8.
And if you can see the beauty in the idea of two lines never, never, never meeting, in other words, there never being an end to something, if you can hold that thought in suspension, then somewhere I think you touch on the beauty of the fabric of the nature of our lives.
The storytelling fabric couldn't be more complex. Simon McBurney links Ramanujan's feeling of being a stranger in a strange land to Indians currently working in call centers or as maids in the UK. And he sets it all in a multimedia environment where the actors, a live percussionist, and a pair of dancers are enveloped in almost continuous video and audio tracks.
Ideas. Like all human needs, food, sleep, warmth, require a search, a going elsewhere. In our imaginations, we leave the immediately present, the center of the circle, and when we do so, we begin to count.
Simon somehow manages to make really abstract ideas become intensely human.
Nigel Redden is artistic director of the Lincoln Center Festival, which is presenting A Disappearing Number. He says McBurney makes the ideas of infinity and string theory come to life.
And what he does, and he does this remarkably theatrically, is he weaves all the stories together so you realize how close we are to each other and somehow makes that a very moving and kind of visceral epiphany.
Towards the end of the play, Al and Anindar, a physicist who've met purely by chance on a plane to India, stand at the banks of a river. It's where mathematician Ramanujan died far too young at the age of 32. Both men are carrying the ashes of loved ones.
Now I'm going to put her in the river and say my last words to her. Although, really, I'm always talking to her.
On the other side of infinity. That's a barrier I can't get over. Everything makes sense but that. When you're gone forever.
Why not think of it like this? The numbers in infinity go on forever. In all directions. But there are no gaps between the numbers. Like there are no gaps in time or space. They are continuous.
Continuous.
And if time is continuous, then we are linked to the past and future. And if space is continuous, we are linked to the absent.
The characters and ideas in A Disappearing Number will only be present for 5 performances at the Lincoln Center Festival, starting tonight. But the play will be shown in high-definition broadcasts at movie theaters throughout the U.S. this October. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
A California couple have become the unlikely stars of the family blog world. They have a few thousand fans on Facebook, and thousands more visit their website every day. Not bad for two lovebirds pushing the century mark. Gloria Hillard brings us their story from Los Angeles.
At the Hollenbeck Palms Retirement and Nursing Home in Los Angeles, they're just Harry and Barbara. He's 98 years old and she's 93.
Hi, baby dear.
Hello.
How are you?
But to their thousands of internet fans, they're the OGs, short for Original Grandparents. Just click on their website, theogs.com.
Oh, wow! Oh, gee, it's the OGs, Barbara and Harry.
It's where Barbara and Harry Cooper, married 72 years, espouse charming advice, wisdom, and uncensored wit in featured videos like Around the Hood, sort of like field trips with the couple, to restaurant reviews. Ask Grandma Anything is the most popular video blog, and no subject is off limits.
Hi, I was just wondering what your position is on lesbians.
Just do your thing, that's all.
Well, how do I feel about lesbian? Good luck to them.
Thanks, Grandpa.
Behind the sometimes shaky camera are the couple's granddaughters, sisters Chinta and Kim Cooper, who a couple of years ago became the primary caregivers to the aging couple. Kim says following visits with her grandparents,
we would just be laughing and going, can you believe what just happened? And then we would just get back to our lives and we thought, what was that cute thing that she said? So I think that was part of the impetus to just lock these moments in amber and keep them and share them and not lose them.
It's rare when the small camera does not capture them kissing or holding hands. And, not surprising, most of their fans write in to ask about the secret of a long-lasting love affair. It's a subject they never seem to tire of, even when asked yet again by a reporter.
As long as she's close by, I'm happy.
But I'm very amusing. I have a lot of tales to tell him.
It's a repartee delivered with show business timing. To Harry's, I couldn't keep my eyes off her. Barbara, her speech sometimes slurred by a stroke, quipped,
we didn't trust each other, so we had to keep an eye on each other. Not really. Not really.
Kim Cooper smiles up at her grandmother and shakes her head.
I never know what she's going to say. She's like the oracle because she doesn't stop to ponder. She has the answer. It's like she's been waiting for this question all her life.
As Chinta gets ready behind the camera, Kim shuffles through the Ask Grandma Anything mail. The first letter is from a young woman concerned about her live-in boyfriend.
And I'm tired of doing his laundry, cleaning up after him, and having no idea whether he's coming home at 5 p.m. or 5 a.m. Your wisdom, please. Thank you.
From her armchair, looking directly into the camera, Barbara doesn't miss a beat.
Pack a suitcase and put it outside the door.
And for a woman considering marriage who's getting cold feet?
Jump in with both feet. You will not feel sorry.
The couple's biggest fans are the two who know them best, Kim and Chinta.
We just sort of go through the world with our grandparents and live, and it's nice.
And they know these days every moment is to be treasured. After lunch in the cafeteria, Chinta sat down with her grandmother at the computer to help her answer her fan email.
Thank you for writing us. We like hearing from you.
From Barbara and Harry?
Good.
For NPR News, I'm Gloria Hillard.
When this summer ends, some teachers will face a new reality. Those in states where a teacher's job security is now tied to how well their students do in class. Some teacher groups have dropped their long-standing opposition to this idea. Still, many teachers fear the new evaluation systems are part of an attack on their profession. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Colorado was at the forefront of an effort to reward teachers who boost student achievement and to get rid of those who do not. After a bitter fight in the legislature, the Colorado branch of the American Federation of Teachers helped broker a deal. Brenda Smith, president of AFT Colorado, says her members recognize it was time to stop resisting an idea whose time has come.
the question that I get most often is, how do I become an active member in building this system? I think our teachers see it as a challenge, and I think they're ready for it.
But that positive attitude masks deep wounds from the fight over the legislation. The much larger Colorado Education Association fought the new evaluation proposal and only embraced it when it was clear it would pass. Spokesperson Deborah Fallon says the bill was a desperate gambit to appease Washington so Colorado could qualify for Race to the Top, an administration program meant to spark education reform.
They felt that this was rammed down their throats.
Now it's Colorado law that half of a teacher's performance evaluation be based on student progress. But the details still have to be worked out. The law doesn't take full effect until 2014. That means teachers can still try to water down the new system if they feel a bad process is being forced on them. Deborah Fallon says districts are in for a surprise as they try to make this change during the worst budget crisis in decades.
Districts do not have the money to train principals to move from evaluating every 3 years to every year.
Wholesale retooling of teacher evaluations has never been tried before on such a huge scale. In a big experiment, there are bound to be mistakes.
Absolutely. This all could go south.
Kate Walsh with the National Center on Teacher Quality says even if most districts do a good job of writing new evaluations, some will screw up, leading to painful stories in the media.
So-and-so has been the star teacher every year. Her peers look up to her. She is absolutely the best teacher around, but her evaluation found her to be unsatisfactory.
Trepidation is widespread from Colorado to Illinois to New York, which also passed a law tying teacher evaluations to student progress. Dick Iannuzzi, president of New York State United Teachers, says his members really are behind the changes, but they also have their guard up as the pressure on teachers grows.
There's more than just a bad taste. There's a real feeling that our allies have joined the blame game. And if we're going to make real reform, it can't be about blaming.
Teachers also warn the hangover from these legislative changes will have consequences in the fall. Deborah Fallon of the Colorado Education Association has this warning for politicians counting on them to get out the vote.
If it's a lovely Saturday morning in October, and I have the choice of staying home and doing what I want to do or going out and walking precincts for somebody, and that person didn't stand up for us on this issue, I just might not go.
Teachers groups spent years fighting the Bush administration's No Child Left Behind law. They now find the struggle continues under a Democratic administration, a sign perhaps that education reform will cause some pain no matter who's in charge. Larry Abramson, NPR News.